It's Friday, March 7th, 2025, and this is the Radical Russ Show.
You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it,
and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty, and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain location in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. Welcome to the program, where there are a lot of changes going on this morning. First of all, we're going to go back to just being an audio program. I got to be straight with you folks. I can't compete in this video live streaming era. I am an old radio podcasting dinosaur. And every time I try to put together some cameras or live streams, I just don't have the tech. I don't have the reliable internet to pull it off. So from now on, this podcast is coming to you audio only, you know, like a podcast. But there is a benefit. We're going to do this every day. That's right. We're going back to a daily podcast now that I don't have to worry about all that video stuff. So I hope you enjoy. I'm just going to join you every morning and give you my take on what's been happening the day before. And we've got a lot to cover on this podcast. We've got 10 Democrats who stabbed Representative Al Green in the back following his protest against President Trump in the State of the Union address. We've got a funny story coming out of those Doge kids trying to purge our government of all terrible, terrible things that the Republicans don't like. And this one's kind of funny, so we'll get to that in the story of the Enola Gay. Also, Elon Musk had another terrible day with Tesla stocks continuing to slip, and maybe it has something to do with the rapid, unscheduled disassemblies that keep happening with his rockets. We've also got another member of the octogenarian Democratic leadership, Senator Dick Durbin out of Illinois, who has no idea how the internet works and wants to hand Donald Trump even more power to squelch our dissent. We'll cover that in the program. And speaking of Trump, the tariffs are on again, off again, on again, off again, and probably on purpose. We'll cover that in our program. And of course, we've got another reason to boycott Idaho coming up on this program. They're trying stuff that they've already tried before and failed. But, if at first you don't succeed, try again when Trump is in office. Maybe it'll go right this time. And our main story on the podcast today is California Governor Gavin Newsom sitting down on his first podcast welcoming the misogynist, transphobic, right-wing Nazi Charlie Kirk as his first guest. All that's coming up on this Radical Russ podcast. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started with this story about Representative Al Green. Of course, on Tuesday was the State of the Union speech. And everywhere on my timeline, everyone on my feed on Blue Sky, which you can follow me at RadicalRust.com on Blue Sky, people have been going off on the need for the Democrats to do something, to actually show that they understand the fight of our lifetime that we're in, the fight for our country that we're all a part of, rather than the same old business as usual. And people were calling for Democrats to walk out of the chamber, to not show up at all, to give a competing press conference, a competing event of something. But it wasn't to be, as Hakeem Jeffries and the rest of the octogenarian Democratic leadership, and I know Hakeem Jeffries is not an octogenarian, but damn it, he might as well be. I mean, I don't see any difference between him and Nancy Pelosi in how he's running this Democratic caucus. And their idea was that we needed to show decorum. We've got to show decorum. We've got to respect the office of the presidency, despite the fact that the person in the office of the presidency doesn't respect it one damn bit. So we got this leaderless, rudderless ship of Democrats who, some of them want to protest, some of them don't want to protest. There's nobody telling them what to do other than just be good little Democrats and don't speak out. And that is not flying. I wish they could just read the room and understand that Democrats, the voters out there, want to see some fight from you guys. But Hakeem Jeffries says everyone maintain decorum, everybody be cool. right? So the State of the Union happens, and some of the Democrats decide, oh, you know what we'll do? We'll coordinate our outfits. Let's all wear pink. Boy, that'll show him. We'll wear some pink, and when he looks out there and sees all that pink, he'll know that we're all wearing pink. I mean, what is the point of that? And then some of them, oh, man, this was so pathetic. They brought those little ping pong paddles with little signs on them. You know, Musk steals, you lie, you know, save Medicaid, whatever they said on them. Which the lettering on them was so small that there's no way Trump out at the podium could even see what they were doing. And so it just looked pathetic. Anyone looking at this to see, you know, I'm going to hold up a little sign. There was all sorts of memes going around about, what was it? The Babylon Bee. The Babylon Bee, you know, that conservative onion, you know, the satire page that's rarely funny. Babylon Bee actually had something funny where they said, you know, the Nazi regime defeated when opponents hold up signs. Right. And then, of course, you know, the right wingers are reposting this, you know, and laughing about it like they're the Nazis who can't be stopped. And they think it's funny the pathetic ways the Democrats are trying to protest this. So finally, we get one Democrat who's got some stones, Representative Al Green from Texas, who stands up shaking his cane. You will not touch Medicaid. We're going to fight against you, Medicaid. And then, of course, Mike Johnson gavels it. You know, we must have decorum. Sergeant at arms, take this man away. Right. Never mind the fact that the past three states of the union under Biden, we had Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, screeching like howler monkeys out there. Never was there a call to sanction them. Never was there a call for the sergeant at arms to take them out. Right. Just to give you some idea of the consistency of Mike Johnson and the Republicans here. They don't give a damn about decorum. They give a damn about squelching Democratic dissent. That's why they came down so quickly on Al Green to get him kicked out. Because if the people can sense that there is a movement, that there is some leadership, that there's some righteous anger out there to get behind, the Republicans know that that's a chance it could snowball and really affect them. So they got him kicked out as soon as he could, and he said, I'll take my punishment, but I'm not going to stand here and just let them attack Medicaid. And the Democrats, I know the people on my timeline were thrilled. It's like, oh, my God, finally someone's standing up for us. Finally someone's showing some righteous anger. So the next day, as was expected, the Republicans put forth a measure to censure Al Green. Now, censure is, you know, it's a mark on your permanent record. Remember back that in high school, in junior high? This will go on your permanent record. That's what we're talking about, right? So it's not, you know, they're not taking his paycheck away or suspending him or anything like that. It's just a black mark on your record. So they take the vote, and it's going along party lines until 10 Democrats actually signed on with the Republicans to censure Al Green. And those Democrats were Barra from California, Case from Hawaii, Costa from California, Gillen from New York, Himes of Connecticut, Houlihan of Pennsylvania, Kaptur of Ohio, Moskowitz of Florida, Glusenkamp of Washington, and Swazi of New York. 10 Democrats who voted to censure another Democrat for speaking out against Trump trying to attack Medicaid. It's like this party has no idea how this is playing to the rest of their potential voters. It once again shows that trying to get Democrats to move on something to attack the right is almost impossible. But boy, when it's a chance to punch left, they can't wait to punch left. Can't wait. Oh, well, show we're not lefties. Oh, no, we're not lefties. And the really frustrating part about this is you might make an argument. Like if you're a Tom Suozzi out of New York's 3rd District, where Trump won by +5 over Harris in the last election, you might make an excuse there. You might say, well, you know, he's in a purple district. He's in a red district. And, you know, he's trying to court those Trump voters. And you might say that for Glusenkamp of Washington. That Washington 3 was a Trump +3 district, right? And Kaptur of Ohio 9, that was a Trump +7 district. Now, I wouldn't make that excuse, right? But at least if you were trying to make an excuse, you could point out, well, you know, I'm from a Trump district, and you know, I had to kind of toe the center. But the other seven Democrats all came from districts that Harris won. And the case of four of them won by double digits. Case in Hawaii's first district, Harris won by 23 points. Himes of Connecticut 4, Harris won by 23 points. Who was that vote for? Who were you trying to convince that you deserve re-election in your heavily blue district that you need to punch left and censure a fellow Democrat? This party is just clueless. They're just completely off the rails when it comes to understanding what the people want right now. We don't want you to fight fellow Democrats. We want you all to band together to fight this menace in the Oval Office, this coup that is currently underway that you refuse to call a coup. This is a fascist coup we're living under, and Democrats still refuse to act like it. All right, something a little bit funnier here coming from this Trump maladministration. You know how these Doge guys have been trying to purge DEI from all government records, all government websites, all government policies. And of course, DEI standing for diversity, equity, and inclusion. They always like to just say DEI because it doesn't sound so good to be against diversity. I'm against diversity. I'm against equity. I'm against inclusion. We should always make them say that. But this DEI purge has been going on, and they've been taking down all references to, you know, people being transgender, or references to, you know, affirmative action, or any sort of racial disparities that might exist. And the latest thing that come across, is it turns out these Doge kids, going through some of the archives of World War II, deleted references to the airplane that dropped the first atomic weapons on Japan. Because the name of that airplane is the Enola Gay. It had the word gay in it. Now, never mind that that's a person's name we're talking about, not the plane being homosexual or anything, right? These kids, the supposed wonder kids, you know, these geniuses that are going to go through and fix all of the problems of our woke federal government, are basically doing a control F on words they don't like. Control F gay. Oh, there's gay. Get rid of everything that's gay. It's just crazy. It's just crazy. It's just unbelievable. In other news, we had another one of these so-called rapid unscheduled disassemblies of a SpaceX rocket over the Bahamas. You got to love that euphemism, right? Rapid unscheduled disassembly. It makes me miss George Carlin. Oh my God, what would George Carlin do with something like that? So another SpaceX rocket exploding. Unfortunately, Elon Musk wasn't on it. But this is becoming a problem, folks. They had to have all sorts of flights over the Caribbean having to be diverted because of this exploding rocket showering debris all throughout the skies. Isn't it time to nationalize SpaceX? I mean, it's hard for me to believe we've gotten in this position that we're in, where a sizable chunk of our national space program relies on this one private company run by a ketamine addict Nazi. And it's been building. I mean, this they were getting contracts throughout the Biden administration, right? You know, this is a bipartisan thing. And it's part of a larger problem with what we've got going on in politics right now, is that we've got one party that absolutely hates government, right? The Republicans absolutely hate government. It goes back to Grover Norquist saying they wanted a government small enough they could drown it in the bathtub, right? They hate government. They think everything should be privatized. They're looking to privatize the post office, privatize Amtrak. Because in their mind, business is the way everything is done, and everything must be done for a profit. Well, that's not what government is for. Government is the opposite of business. Government is the opposite of business. It's not supposed to make a profit. It's supposed to provide services. We have a government for six reasons: to provide the common defense, promote the general welfare, ensure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. You know, the whole preamble to the Constitution, right? That's why we have a government. Nowhere in that preamble does it says we form a more perfect union and to make sure we make profit. Profit don't enter into it and shouldn't enter into it. Government is a service. And we used to believe in government. We used to have, you know, the Republicans, of course, have hated government forever. They always wanted to shrink it, to kill it. But now we're in a situation where Democrats operate from the same frame. They start off with agreeing that, oh, yes, there's waste in government. Oh, yes, there's fraud in government. Oh, yes, the government shouldn't handle everything. I mean, just the other day, Pete Buttigieg was talking about this, was going off about, you know, we agree that there's fraud and waste, but this way that the way that DOGE is going about it isn't the right way. Why do we start with agreeing with Republicans? By starting in their frame that government is by definition full of fraud and waste. Let's not start there. Let's get back to a time when at least one party believed that big government could be good government. That big government could do grand things like build an interstate highway system, like eradicate measles, like create the internet, like go to the moon. There was a time when we understood that big projects, big national projects for the common good were something that the government was supposed to do. That's why we have a government. Because everything can't be for profit. Can you imagine Eisenhower trying to build the federal highway system for profit? Because, you know, they would have done it if they could have gotten away with it. We'd have toll freeways all around this country. And I already know we've got turnpikes and toll roads, you know, and, you know, East Coast and some places in California. But this would be national. Like, you wouldn't be able to travel interstate, there'd be tolls everywhere if the highway system had to run a profit. So let's get out of this idea that private, there's the public-private partnership, which is really just subsidies for rich people, subsidies for these corporations. Now, I got no problem with people, you know, if they want to have a private space program, if Jeff Bezos Richard Branson and Elon Musk all want to have dick measuring contests with who's got the biggest rocket. Great. Blow your money however you want to blow it. But let's not have the United States government and our space program dependent on SpaceX. Or, for that matter, let's talk about Starlink, too. The Starlink satellite system. The majority of our communication satellites up there are owned, again, by this one ketamine-fueled Nazi billionaire. It's time to either nationalize these companies or start to extract the United States government from these companies. I'm more hopeful for the latter because, you know, nationalization, boy, that's a way lefty thing that I'm sure there's no political appetite for within the Democratic Party. The octogenarian Democratic leadership strikes again in the form of 80-year-old Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, Democrat from Illinois, who's second or third in the power structure in the Democratic Party, I forget which. But Durbin has been going off on Section 230. Now, if you don't know Section 230, it's basically a part of the law governing the internet that says internet service providers can't be sued over the content that's on their platform. The person who put that on the platform might be able to be sued, but not the content provider themselves, right? So, like, you know, you put up a website on, you know, GoDaddy or whatever, or you post something on Facebook or Twitter or Blue Sky, whatever, and you post on one of these platforms, you can be sued for the stuff you say, but not Facebook or not Blue Sky or not GoDaddy or whoever. And this is an extremely necessary part of our free speech laws, because if you can just directly sue the platform for whatever junk someone posted on their blog or their social media page, then these places would pretty much have to squelch a lot of free speech, or some of them might even get shut down over this, right? So Section 230 is something that's been with us since the early days of the internet, to understand that the free speech can't be fostered on platforms that are terrified of being sued for someone abusing their free speech. But Dick Durbin has a different view. Dick Durbin has come across saying we need to repeal Section 230 to hold these platforms accountable for trying to addict kids to social media, to screen time, whatever, and the sales of drugs. They're trying to get kids addicted to drugs because, you know, people can talk about drugs on the internet. And I got to tell you, you always got to watch your wallet and watch your rights anytime a politician is trying to tell you they're doing something for the good of the kids. What about the children? Won't somebody think of the children? Anytime you hear that, you know, something bad is happening. Something wrong is afoot. Because first of all, we got to get away from this thought in America that we have to nerf the world to make it perfectly safe for kids in the realm of adult functions, right? Let's let adults be adults here, right? And as far as getting kids addicted to the internet or addicted to drugs, they don't need Facebook for that. They don't need MySpace, YouTube, any of these kind of... MySpace? I don't think MySpace is around anymore, Russ, but whatever. They don't need any help here. As Chris Rock once said, drugs don't need to be sold. Drugs sell themselves. But again, trying to be a moral crusader, 80-year-old Dick Durbin, who probably has to have his assistants set his passwords for him, is trying to shut down our internet free speech. And to do so now, when we've got Nazis in the White House, to try to give them more power to silence dissent at this time? Geez, Durbin, read the room. Check out the historical analogs here of what's going on. This is the last time you want to give more power to the federal government to shut down free speech. Once again, the tariffs are on. No, wait. Let me check again. The tariffs are off. Wait, now they're on again. Following what's going on with Trump and this trade war has been hilarious. Trying to be Mr. Big Man, Mr. Bluster. We're gonna show Canada. We're going to show Mexico. Oh, we're going to put 25% tariffs on their stuff. And then as soon as the stock market responds to this and crashes, what was it, you know, 1,800 points in 3 days, something like that? Now suddenly we're reversing the tariffs. Oh, we don't really need the tariffs. Well, what is it, right? He comes out saying, oh, we got to have these tariffs to protect America. They're taking advantage of us. They're terrible. But then he goes and rescinds the tariffs because he had a nice phone call with President Sheinbaum of Mexico. So what is it? Are the tariffs helpful, harmful? What? This is crazy. And the markets are reacting to it. And it's getting to the point now where it doesn't matter if he keeps the tariffs off. They're so spooked now that this is such a hodgepodge, ad hoc, impulsive administration. You can't base your business on that. You can't make any long-term plans of what you're going to purchase for inventory, how you're going to produce your products, not knowing whether tomorrow there's going to be a 25% tariff and then Thursday there's not and then next week there is. And I got to believe this is purposeful, right? I think again, another problem the Democrats have is they keep trying to sell this as if, oh boy, Trump and the Trump administration sure are bad at this. They sure don't know how to run the government. We'd run the government so much better. We Democrats, we'd be so much better. Folks, this isn't accidental. They're not making mistakes. This is purposeful. You announce a tariff, the stock market tanks, billionaires come up and buy a whole bunch of the stocks when they're cheaper. You announce the tariff is off, the stock goes back up. Billionaires who just bought that stock just made a whole bunch of money. They're turning the stock market into a pump and dump, the whole damn market. Just a way to fleece more money out of the population. And again, the goal here is to disrupt and destroy the federal government, to crater our economy, to create conditions so horrible. Grandmas getting kicked off Social Security, being kicked out of their retirement homes. Kids having to come back to being homeschooled because their special ed has been canceled by DOGE. Federal workers losing their jobs. No, wait, you can have your job back. You were important. We needed you. No, wait, you're fired again. No, wait, send us an email with the 12 things, the 5 things that you do. No, wait, don't send the email. No, wait, we need you back. This is all purposeful chaos. This is all on purpose to try to destroy America. Which, again, we're still waiting for Democrats to recognize that they are trying to destroy America. All purposeful. All a scheme to try to destroy the markets, the confidence in the markets, confidence in the United States of America. Time for another look at our continuing campaign to boycott Idaho. That's right, boycott Idaho, the handmade state. We've talked about their terrible abortion laws and their terrible drug laws. We're going to get back to their drug laws on this one because the Idaho legislature, I got a call from a reporter at Politico asking me about this because the Idaho legislature has put forth another resolution. And this one is a resolution to try to put forth a constitutional amendment in the state of Idaho. Because in the state of Idaho, they have the initiative power. Citizens can gather enough signatures from voters to put stuff on the ballot to be passed into law. Now, they don't have the ability to pass constitutional amendments. That can only be done by the legislature. But citizens can pass laws. And recently, in 2018, the citizens put together an initiative through a group called Reclaim Idaho that expanded Medicaid in the state. In fact, I've got a total knee replacement thanks to the state of Idaho's Medicaid expansion, which the Republicans in Idaho, remember, it's a supermajority Republican state, the Republicans have been rejecting this free money from the federal government for years. It finally took the citizens to put together an initiative and passed it by 61%, mind you. Supermajority. That would even count in Florida. Pass this law to expand Medicaid. So the Idaho legislature has been trying for years to try to restrict the initiative power. And it wasn't always about Medicaid expansion. It was always about medical marijuana. Since 1996, when California passed its medical marijuana initiative, and then 1998, Oregon and Washington followed, there has been a palpable fear at the Idaho legislature that someone's going to come along with a bunch of out-of-state money and pass medical marijuana in the state of Idaho. As you may know, Idaho is the only Western state that has no form of legal marijuana. All the states surrounding it are legal marijuana states: Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, Montana, and of course the nation of Canada is also legal marijuana. The other two states that border Idaho, Utah and Wyoming, Utah has medical marijuana, and Wyoming has a limited sort of CBD medical marijuana. Idaho's got none of that, right? All forms of marijuana in the state of Idaho are illegal, can get you arrested, thrown in the back of a cop car, and give you a criminal record for the rest of your life for a joint. Now, nevertheless, marijuana persists in Idaho. The city of Ontario, Oregon, is this little border town. It's got 11,000 people. It's on the Idaho border. about an hour west of Boise. Little Ontario, Oregon, 11,000 people in Malheur County, which is a county of 30,000 people. And it's the largest county in Oregon. It's like the entire southeastern corner of Oregon is Malheur County, which, by the way, is French for tragic. Tragic county. Home of the tater tot, by the way. Ontario, Oregon was where the tater tot was invented. A little bit of Oregon trivia for you. Little Ontario, Oregon, with 11,000 people, has 12 marijuana shops, 12 legal marijuana shops, and those shops every month sell $8 million worth of marijuana, 90 to 95% of it to Idahoans. You go to the parking lots of these dispensaries and it's nothing but Idaho plates. So everybody knows that people are coming from Idaho, and that metro area, the Boise metro area, that southwestern corner of Idaho, has about 850,000 people. Malheur County, that little county of 30,000 people, is always third in total sales across the entire state of Oregon. It only falls behind the two counties, Washington County and Multnomah County, that are the Portland metro counties, right? And we're talking million plus people that live in that metro area, right? So clearly Idahoans like to smoke pot. And clearly they're buying $8 million of it every month. And that's just the Oregon border. You go up to Washington, up there in the panhandle, they're getting it from Spokane, about $3 million a month. And you go down to the Twin Falls area, they can drive 45 minutes south to Jackpot, Nevada. And they're buying, I haven't done the figures on that one, but it's probably close to $500,000 to $1 million. Even eastern Idaho, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, can drive north up into Montana now and get legal marijuana. So the Idaho legislature hates this. They absolutely hate it, and they're terrified that someone's going to come along and pass an initiative to legalize medical marijuana. Now, other things they have tried is to gut the initiative power. They've tried to... In Idaho, you got to pass to get an initiative on the ballot, you got to get 6% of the voter signature statewide, but there's also a regional requirement where you have to get 6% in each of 18 of 35 of the legislative districts, right? So you can't just go to Boise and get all 6% of your signatures. You got to go to 18 different legislative districts and get 6% in each of them. And the logic behind this is, well, we don't want just the city folk to decide. We want to have statewide buy-in, which is kind of BS anyway, because most of the legislative districts are concentrated near the cities anyway, so it's a wash. Regardless, there's this 18 out of 35 requirement. The legislature has been trying to up that requirement. Now, 3-4 years back, they had this brilliant idea that, you know what we'll do? We'll make you have to get 35 out of 35. You have to get 6% in all 35 districts. Now, that went all the way to the Idaho Supreme Court, which declared it unconstitutional for the simple reason that it gives one district veto power. All 34 of 35 districts could come up with their 6%, but if one district fell short of 6%, the whole thing's vetoed. And the Idaho Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional because you're basically making it impossible to pass an initiative. You're taking the initiative right away from the people. So this legislative session, they tried the same damn thing. They put forth the same bill to make it 35 out of 35. Even after it's already been declared unconstitutional. And I suppose they're thinking, well, you know, Trump's in power now, so all bets are off. Well, this brings me to the latest reason to boycott Idaho, and it's their latest attempt to try to kill the initiative power, at least when it comes to passing medical marijuana. They are proposing an amendment to the Idaho Constitution that says only the legislature can make drug laws. They're basically trying to take one subject, drug laws, and make it something you can't pass an initiative over. Yeah, talk about your prior restraint, right? There's all sorts of violations here, like First Amendment, you know, content restrictions, that kind of stuff. And guess what, folks? They tried this before. They've already tried this. And it didn't get to the point where it was adjudicated by the courts. It died in the Senate, I believe, when they tried this before. Because people pointed out a few problems. Like, number one, you're making one subject something that can't be an initiative, which kind of seems unconstitutional on its face. But number two, you're giving the legislature the power to set pharmaceutical laws. These people aren't pharmacists. They're not scientists. They don't know anything about chemistry or physiology or, you know, the human medical condition. Why would you put these guys in charge of which drugs can be scheduled or unscheduled? And they notice that there are some unintended consequences with this, which is that new drugs are developed all the time. And the way that the drug scheduling works now is if there's analogs to certain drugs, they automatically fit in this category or that category. Well, that would be taken away too. So in their zeal to try to stop marijuana from making the ballot, they'd make it so every single medicine, every single new drug that was developed would have to go through the committee hearings and the markups and the amendments and the votes and the signing by the governor. Meanwhile, people who could use that drug are dying. I'm telling you, folks, there is no state in America that hates marijuana more than the state of Idaho. In fact, in 2013, they passed a resolution saying, "It's the sense of the Idaho legislature that marijuana shall never, ever be legalized for any purpose whatsoever by anybody for any reason." I'm paraphrasing a little, but to my knowledge, Idaho is the only state that has ever proactively gone out of its way to say marijuana shall never be legal. So, for my money, if there's any state you want to bet on to be the last state to legalize marijuana, if ever, you could do worse than betting on the handmade state. All right, to close up the show, I want to talk about Gavin Newsom, governor of California, which I have had the opportunity to have direct one-on-one conversations with this man. As the California legalization campaigns were heating up throughout 2010, 2012, and so forth, I had opportunities to interview Gavin Newsom and speak to him privately. So I was excited for years that maybe someday somebody that I've spoken to personally could be president of the United States. But boy, that pride is gone now. Gavin Newsom is just revealing himself to be another one of these focus group, poll-tested, finger in the wind, which way is the wind blowing, Democratic politicians. It's just sad to see. And the latest example comes with the debut of his brand new podcast. And his very first guest that he has on the podcast is Charlie Kirk, the human thumb. You know, that guy with the big head and the small face, little beady eyes. Yeah, Charlie Kirk, this guy who gets hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars from the right wing to produce his podcast of hate, is the first guest for the Democratic governor of the largest, most populous, most powerful blue state we've got. As if this guy needed a platform on the left. What was the point of even inviting this guy, Gavin? And from what I understand throughout the interview and throughout the podcast, he's agreeing with Charlie Kirk and asking him, you know, gee, what do we Democrats need to do to win elections? As if we need to look to the right to try to win elections. What is it with this Democratic Party? We just ran the best centrist Republican candidate of my lifetime, Kamala Harris. Yeah, I know she's a Democrat in name, I know. But come on. She's out there campaigning with Liz Cheney, someone who's called Democrats terrible names in the past. How much further to the right do we have to reach? This is something that just infuriates me about Democrats, is that they keep thinking America is some sort of conservative country. And I believe, really, they're still in shell shock from Reagan kicking their ass in the 80s and three straight Republican terms. But I've looked at the numbers on this. I was looking at the numbers from Gallup on political affiliation. How do you register? How do you think of yourself politically, right? And it's a chart that shows, you know, the support for Republicans, the support for Democrats, and the support for independents. You know, who, are you an independent? Are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican, right? So you follow these lines, and for the most part, Democrats are above Republicans on, you know, how many people identify with that party. As you look through the 90s and up through the 2000s, the Democrats are a few points above the Republicans. More people think of themselves as Dems than think of themselves as Republicans, but more people still think of themselves as independents, except for a brief period. There was a couple of years there where there were even more Democrats than there were independents. And where it peaks is 2008. When you look at that Democratic line of who recognizes themselves as a Democrat, it peaks at about 36% of the country identifying as Democrats as Barack Obama is running for president. After Barack Obama, that Democratic line has gone steadily downwards to the point now where there's an equal percentage of Democrats and Republicans at 27%. 27% of the people think of themselves as Republicans, 27% think of themselves as Democrats. And that independent line has skyrocketed to now over 40% consider themselves independent. Now, the Republican line hasn't really gone down much. It's the Democratic line since Barack Obama that has clearly declined. And my theory behind this is that there is a hunger out here for a party of the people, a party of the left, a party that stands opposed to the rapaciousness and greed of big business and elevates the poor and helps those in need. There is a hunger out there for us to join the rest of the civilized world and have public health care and public education and bullet trains and all the things that modern civilized societies get to enjoy. And a frustration that there's nobody standing for us. There's no Democrats out there that see that. So here comes Barack Obama in 2008. Mr. Hope, Mr. Change, Mr. Si Se Puede. And let's not forget that it wasn't ordained for Obama to become president in 2008. It was ordained that Hillary would. Remember, if you remember, that was like the sure thing that was going to happen. Oh, yeah, George W. Bush, and the next thing you know, Hillary will be president because she's next. You know, Democrats have this thing about seniority and leadership, right? So she's next. It's her turn. And she ran the typical Democratic centrist, pro-friendly to business, let's stay away from the gay and all that kind of stuff. She ran that kind of campaign back in 2008 and was shocked when this unknown junior senator from Illinois started rising in the polls because he was speaking to what the people wanted, the hope, the change, that we could close Guantanamo, that we could raise the minimum wage, that we could have public option health care, that we could end the war on drugs. I was there in 2008. I remember all these campaign promises. I was actually at Obama's DNC coronation in 2008 as an accredited blogger. I remember the joy, the feeling, and when Barack Obama won, the elation in this nation that finally we've turned this corner, we've gotten out of this pro-business, this centrist Democrat, we pushed past Hillary and the establishment Democrats, we got this young hope and change agent in, and what happened? We gave him a plus 7% popular vote mandate. The biggest popular vote mandate of the 21st century. And pretty close to one of the biggest ones of the 20th as well. We gave him a Senate that had, at the start, 57 senators, Democratic senators. And at one point, when Arlen Specter switched from Republican to Democrat, yes, believe it or not, there used to be a time when Republicans became Democrats. When Arlen Specter switched, we had, for a brief time, 60 Democrats in the Senate, a filibuster-proof Senate for 183 days in 2009. And we had a House of Representatives that was at least plus 50 on the Democratic side. So here we had Mr. Hope and Change, break through the Democratic establishment, close Gitmo, get us a minimum wage increase, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the big Democratic wins you needed to be able to exercise that power. And what happened? We didn't codify Roe. Gitmo stayed open. Minimum wage never got raised. Public option health care was discarded in favor of a Republican health care plan. And of course, Roe v. Wade never got codified because there were other priorities at the time. Barack Obama, after getting elected, tacked immediately to the center, just like every other Democrat. And from that point on, that's where that Democratic leaning, that's where that Democratic brand began falling. That's where we went from 36% of the country identifying as Democrats to now just 27% identifying as Democrats. Which brings me back to Gavin Newsom. Here we are in this place where the Democratic brand has been sliding downwards since 2008. Where every attempt has been made to tack to the center with Hillary's campaign in 2016, with Biden, the ultimate centrist, in 2020, with Kamala Harris in 2024. And the only time we've seen quick and decisive political hardball being played by the Democrats is when someone on the left rises up, like Bernie Sanders, starts winning some primaries, starts filling some halls. And oh boy, they worked quickly to shut that down, didn't they? So we've got an American public that is hungering for Democratic leadership on the left to stand for the people. And we get Gavin Newsom reaching out to the right, asking Charlie goddamn Kirk what Democrats should do to try to win. And the big headline coming from this, of course, is the trans issue. Gavin Newsom goes and says, oh, we're getting hammered. We're getting killed on this trans issue. We're getting killed on the trans issue. And then Charlie Kirk, of course, explaining his side of hating the trans kids and the trans athletes. And then Gavin Newsom comes back and says, well, I agree with you. There's an issue of fairness. I'm worried about my girls having to race against you. Throwing the trans kids under the bus. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this because I have to admit something to my audience. I am a recovering transphobe. Help, help, I'm transphobic. As this issue rose to prominence in America, I wrote a lot about it. I've posted some things on social media and I've written some articles about it, which are transphobic. And I'm trying to undo that. I'm trying to get around that. Now, it's not as if I don't have experience in the issue of knowing trans people. I've worked with three different trans people, two trans women and one trans man. I dated a trans woman briefly in the 90s, and I had a trans roommate. Was a co-blogger with a trans woman. So six. I've known six transgender people in my lifetime. And I like five of them. One of them I really didn't like, and I'm not going to get into why. But clearly, this is an issue where Democrats are having some problems. Because I'm a pretty progressive guy, okay? I'm on the left on everything. But as I came on this trans issue and I listened to the pro-trans side fighting for it, I found the arguments to be lacking, to be some really bad arguments. And we just need to find a better way to talk about this, because there's some failures in the arguments. One of the arguments I hear on the pro-trans side is, especially when it comes to the trans athletes, is, well, there's only like seven trans athletes in the 500,000 Division I athletes in college. There's only seven. That's a terrible argument, folks, because the frame that the other side is coming at you with is that it's unfair. I've got my girl in sports, and it's unfair she has to compete against a trans person. That's the argument is unfairness, and so your response is, well, don't worry. It's only going to be unfair a very small percentage of the time. Because that's that they're coming at the frame that is unfair, and so you say, well, there's only seven of them. Well, yeah, but if it's my one kid against one of the seven, I still feel it's unfair. That's where they're coming from, right? That's a terrible argument. Another one of the terrible arguments is the Michael Phelps argument. This is the one that says, well, okay, so the trans girl might have some advantages since she went through male puberty, but Michael Phelps has advantages too. He has bigger lungs and he processes oxygen better and has the different lactic acid. And there's a, you know, they have a whole laundry list of why Michael Phelps is a superhuman, right? Would it be, is it unfair that everybody has to race against Michael Phelps? Which is another stupid argument. Because the person coming at this for fear of the trans athlete sees sports as being divided into two categories. One, the people with the male bodies that are superior at sports, and two, the people with the female bodies who are inferior at sports compared to the men. So when you bring up this Michael Phelps thing, it's unfair against Michael Phelps, the people on the other side of it say, yeah, but Michael Phelps is a boy. And all the boys racing against him are boys. And so you don't really convince them. In fact, it'd be like, okay, let's suppose Michael Phelps is special. But let's pretend that half of the people out there were Phelpsian. Half of them had these special bodies that were better than normal bodies. And so we made an entire separate swimming category for the people who weren't Phelpsian. And then suddenly one of the Phelpsians says, well, I'm not actually Phelpsian, I'm normal. And I want to race against you normal people. That's where the argument loses in the heads of the transphobe. Once again, you've never gotten around to addressing the fairness aspect of it. So I only bring this up because I'm trying to recover from this transphobia and I'm looking for better arguments. Right now, the thing that puts me on the pro-trans side, the only thing, well, not the only thing, but the primary thing that puts me on the pro-trans side is the people who are on the anti-trans side. When I see the Charlie Kirks and the Matt Walshes and the Ben Shapiros and the Riley Gaines, I can instantly recognize they are hateful, spiteful, bad people. And so I don't want to be on their side. So I support trans issues. But I can't go into an argument with just that. I can't go into an argument with just, Charlie Kirk's a Nazi, so you should support trans people. I need more positive arguments. And I'm finding them. One of the arguments I find that's a little more compelling is to try to redefine what women's sport is. I came into it with the understanding that we created women's sports because women couldn't compete in men's sports. But you know what? That's not really true. There is no sex requirement in the NFL or the NBA or Major League Baseball or Major League Soccer or National Hockey League or any sport that I'm aware of that says only men can compete in this sport. If a woman wants to try out for an NFL team or an NBA team, or there's nothing stopping her. So why do we have women's sports? Women's sports is about inclusion. Women's sports is about giving a place to compete for people who cannot compete with men. And so that would include trans women. And that's where we need to start hammering away at this trans issue, is to point out that trans women are not men. And of course, the transphobes, that's hard for them to get around. But I think we can get other people that aren't heavily invested on the transphobic side to better see that, to better see that this is about inclusion, trying to give everyone a chance to compete, to give everyone the opportunity to play sports. And that there's no way the trans girl, having gone through puberty blockers and taking estrogen and so forth, is going to be able to compete on the male side. Now, this also opens up a can of worms because, okay, someone hasn't gone through puberty blockers. They have experienced male puberty, but now they're on estrogen. What's the difference there? And one of the other things I see as a problem is that for years, we've had this problem with steroids and performance-enhancing drugs, right? We want athletes to compete clean because if an athlete is taking steroids and human growth hormone and all these performance-enhancing drugs, they're risking their health to do so, and they will increase their performance. And then anyone else who wants to be able to keep up with them has to also take steroids to keep up. And so we're forcing people to harm their health in order to compete. And so that's why we want everyone to be clean, no performance-enhancing drugs, right? The issue we've got with trans athletes is kind of the opposite of that. We've got someone who, with a male body, can compete at a higher level, but then we give them performance-decreasing drugs. We take their performance and decrease it by giving them estrogen. We decrease the effects of their puberty by puberty blockers. So it makes it a little more difficult to say, well, how far do you have to decrease before a male body has become equivalent competitively to a female body? It seems like we're trying to come up with performance-decreasing drugs and saying that if we decrease to a certain level, it's fair for you to compete. I don't have answers here, folks. I'm doing this segment looking for answers because it's a tough issue to get around. And I think the sports issue and the prison issue are the two sticking issues because I think a lot of people are fine. You know, in other areas, you know, trans person wants to be a clerk at the grocery store, fine, who cares, right? And it, I think where a lot of us get stuck, I'll just tell you from my experience, because I thought I understood what the trans issue was. You know, growing up, you start to learn things, right? You hear songs, Lola, you know. Girls will be boys and boys will be girls. It's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world for my Lola, right? Or fast forward to the 80s, dude looks like a lady. That dude looks like a lady. Or The Crying Game. Remember that movie, The Crying Game, right? I think for a lot of us, we were in this space where what we understood was that sex was physical. Everybody has a physical sex, male or female. And then everybody also has a gender, which is mental. And the gender can range from masculine to feminine. And that gender doesn't always perfectly match the physical sex. We all grew up with tomboys, right? Physically female, gender kind of male. We grew up with, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but sissies, right? Physically male. Gender-wise, more feminine. And I thought we all understood that, right? We understood that your sex was physical and your gender was mental, and they don't have to match. I thought we were all cool with that. And then we started to understand transgender people were people who were one sex who lived as the other gender. And that seemed okay. That seemed to work, right? Okay, so you're male, but you live as a woman. Okay. And I thought we were all cool. And then somewhere around 2013, as became am. It's not a male living as a woman. That person is a woman. Trans women are women. It's no longer someone of one sex living as a different gender. Now sex and gender are the same thing. They're all changeable. They're all mutable. And that's where I think people are like lost on this. It's like, wait a minute. We were, this was people living as a certain gender. Now they just are women. So someone in good faith could ask, okay, well then what is a woman? Like the Matt Walsh thing, right? And then the answer they get back is, a woman is someone who covers their drink whenever you're around. Which, you know, appropriate answer for someone like Matt Walsh. But for some, you know, Bible-thumping mom in Indiana who's legitimately asking, like, okay, I used to know what female was. Female meant you had a vagina and male meant you had a penis. But now you're saying a woman can have penises and men can have vaginas. And so what is the difference between man and woman? And no one will tell them. Or they'll give them some snide remark. That's where I think we're having some problems here. As became am. So I'm going to wrap this up because I'll admit it. I don't yet find the arguments on the pro-trans side to be logically compelling yet. Other than people should be able to live however they want to live. People should be able to identify however they want to identify. But it's making it difficult to try to sell to the rest of the people out there. Another example, the whole pronoun thing. It's interesting to me how the folks on the left see people freaking out on the right about the pronouns as being a whole much ado about nothing. Like, why would you be offended about having to put your pronouns in an email, on your email signature, something like that? And I want to try to explain this from the point of view of the people who are pissed off about it, right? Because one of the things transgender people hate, deservedly so, rightfully so, is being misgendered, right? Don't misgender me. I'm presenting as a woman, and you shall treat me and call me as a woman. Okay, great. That's respect. That's cool. Let's do that. But when you're telling someone who's cisgender that they have to put their pronouns in their email signature, in a sense, they feel misgendered. From their point of view, they've been a boy or a girl. I'll just speak from my point of view. They've been a boy all their life. They've always worn boy clothes and gone by a boy name. And people have always called them boy because everything about them outwardly shows they are a boy. So when someone's got this perception of themselves as a boy and has always outwardly presented themselves as a boy, and then you come to them and say, well, we need you to put your pronouns in an email so someone knows you're a boy. To them, it's like, well, what do you think I've been doing this whole time? What, I don't look boy enough to you? It's not obvious I'm a boy? It feels misgendering to them. Now, if the whole pronoun thing had been, you know, someone who's trans then puts their pronouns in their email so that they don't get misgendered, and they choose to do that, great. But when you start compelling it out of other people, it makes them feel like they're not presenting their gender well enough to be for people to be able to see what their gender is. That's where I think the pronoun thing went off the rails, is when we started compelling people in the workplace or schools or wherever that everybody has to put the pronoun in because nobody can tell what gender you might be. That's where it felt weird to people. Now, again, disclaimer, I will vote in favor of every pro-trans law that comes around. I will vote against every anti-trans law that comes around. But at this point, I'm only doing it because the people on the other side are hateful bigots. Not because I understand or endorse the arguments that are coming forth to support these trans issues. And I'll admit my ignorance. I'll admit my transphobia. And I would love to talk to someone about this in good faith. But I've tried on the internet. I have tried to ask about this on the internet, and it's not pleasant. Everybody assumes your arguments are in bad faith. Everybody assumes that you hate trans people when you say anything that's even close to questioning about it. And that, of course, you know, I'm bold this way. I'll keep going, and I'll keep asking and keep trying to learn. But not most people. Most people get turned off by that.
A woman is someone who puts their hand over their drink when you come around.
And that person goes, oh, okay. I guess Charlie Kirk was right. I guess Matt Walsh was right. So we need to do a better job on this issue. We need to do more forthright, honest, good faith discussions about it. I think the people can change on the issue. They've changed on the gay marriage issue. They changed on the marijuana legalization issue. I think we can change on this trans issue, but we're not being helped when Governor Gavin Newsom is tacking to the right and bringing on the progenitors of the transphobic arguments to give them a platform. We can do better. All right, folks, that's all the time we've got for the Radical Rush Show this morning. And remember, starting Monday, we're going to be here every morning giving you anywhere from 15 minutes to a full hour of talk about what's been happening. If you'd like to get your comments on the air, you can always call me. I have got a message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. You can email me, radicalruss@gmail.com, and you can find me at radicalruss.com on Blue Sky and the web. The Radical Russ Show is produced by Radical Russ Media, LLC, and is governed by Creative Commons Share Attribution. My theme music is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and segment music tracks are Drifting, Passed Away, Take That, Heroes, Feel the Epic, and Next Level by VTEMO, courtesy of freetouse.com/music. For everyone here at Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain location in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon, I'm Radical Russ Belleville. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.